I watched this movie, The Book of Eli.
Let's go ahead and get started.
That's what that story was
So, we're on the second lesson where we're covering the Psalms. There is material on the chair here for next time will be in Isaiah. Note that that's a week from today or one of the classes in the meeting. Let's review a little bit what we talked about last time. These are just the objectives. Do you remember the criteria we talked about for determining if the psalm is messianic?
It mentions the Son of God.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. A. Right. Both of those actually. The Son of God, Jehovah, referencing David or his descendants. We'll look at that one a little bit more today. And then the kind of slam dunk, I guess, is if it's quoted by Jesus or the apostles as messianic. And by the way, it's probably worth noting there is a difference. Some psalms are quoted in the New Testament not in a messianic sense, just to say, like, you know, this is consistent, or the author said something like that. But the context is usually pretty clear about if it's messianic or not. That's not animated correctly. And neither is the next one.
Psalms connected up.
Yeah, so how does messianic prophecy expand in the Psalms? The Psalms connect the dots of these early messianic images that we saw in the Pentateuch, and they introduce this three character description of the Messiah. The king and the priest and the suffering servant. And then the view of kingship in the book kind of changes. We saw this last time as you progress through the book, which is not necessarily in kind of chronological order, but it's arranged to give us a picture of how the Israelites understood this kingship promise to be fulfilled. And the reason that I think Psalm 89 is so critical to our understanding both of the book and of Jesus as the Messiah is that it kind of captures that moment when Israel was forced, because there was no other alternative, to trust in God's kingship and not the Davidic kingship, because the Davidic kingship had disappeared. And so the book of Psalms as a whole, among other kind of broad themes that it addresses, it narrates this transition from a sort of fixation on the Davidic kingship into a better, more whole picture trust in God as the king. Which didn't mean that the Davidic promise went away or that they didn't still believe in it, but the book kind of helps us to see that that they finally understood what God wanted them to know all along, which was that he was their king. any other comments or questions about Lesson 8? We kind of ended a little bit abruptly last time. Okay, so today, just two objectives. I'd like you to be able to explain how the kingship psalms build on the promise to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7, and then identify how the messianic psalms are quoted in the New Testament. This is a very broad description, but I think it'll be useful as you study the New Testament and see how it interacts with the book of Psalms. So just to review again our three periods of messianic prophecy. We're in kind of this period here, the second two periods of the early kingdom in the Psalms and the later kingdom in the prophets. But as I said last time, I put the Psalms more or less in the early kingdom period, partly because so many of them are written by David, but also partly because even the Psalms that are written clearly much later in Israel's history don't really address the clearer images of the Messiah that are present in the prophets, even that they had available to them. Doesn't mean they didn't know about them. It just means that the Psalms, in the way that they are edited for us, are working on an earlier model of kingship, and kind of helping us transition into the view of the Messiah that the prophets are going to outline. So next time we'll be looking at Isaiah in the next three classes, and we'll see the images that we've been talking about in Psalms kind of expanded and built on. And in fact, that's one of our objectives for today, is to kind of notice that how the Psalms talk about the Messiah, the Son of David, and what that means for the books that are coming up. So what we've been doing in this class is we talked about this overarching theme of God as Israel's true king, and there's a whole genre that's about that, and notice how they're all organized. Well, that's not the full list of them. I've got that later. But they're organized to be mostly later in the book. We talked about Israel's king as God's son, that he becomes the king when he's anointed, and kind of what that meant for Jesus' resurrection. Then today we're going to talk about this this other feature or criteria, which is the feature of David the king. And then we'll talk about Psalms as they're quoted in the New Testament by Jesus and the apostles. So I want to review this as well. Get through all this review and set up stuff quickly so we can get to the Psalms that I want to talk about today, because there's some really cool things in them. So forgive me for just sort of talking through all this very quickly and not. But we talked about this last time, the place of the Psalms in understanding Revelation. And I want you to remember that they come at this really key point when the national consciousness is shifting from the land and the nation promise to the seed promise. And that idea is, if you'll pardon the pun, germinating and is starting to blossom into a fuller image that the prophets are going to give us more detail on, but the Psalms are definitely the beginning of that, of the descriptions that we have of the seed promise. And so for this third point of changes in Israelite thought, we're going to look today at one of these important developments, which is not just a kingship, which had been discussed in Deuteronomy, and then Saul was the king, and there was some confusion when he was removed from the, when he was killed, about who was going to be the next king and all that kind of stuff. But in the Psalms, we see that it's not just a kingship, it's actually the Davidic kingship, kingship in the line of David. So the kingship psalms, I realize I didn't kind of put these on a single slide for you to have. I need to make these slides available online. I apologize for not doing that. Psalms of the Earthly King, you can see they're spread through the whole book. If you read them, you'll notice the shift in how the king is described and how he's talked about. And it's a shift, because you start to recognize some of these numbers, it's a shift towards a more, what we would call, messianic view. And we'll talk a little bit about what that means. And so it's about the duties of the king to execute justice, mercy, and righteousness. We saw that in Psalm 2. References to the lineage of David, we'll see that today. Description of the king as the son of God, we saw that in Psalm 2, and it's in most of these other ones as well. And references to, especially in the early Psalms, to being enthroned in Jerusalem. The Psalms of the heavenly king, on the other hand, which mostly occur later in the book, are descriptions of God as superior to the earthly king. And you can see that in each of these descriptors. So he's not just responsible for executing justice, mercy, and righteousness. God is the source of that. He's the arbiter of what is right and wrong, what is just and unjust. Instead of the king deriving his authority from his lineage, God is the one who invests them with their authority. That is, he is sort of self-authoritative and is able to pass that on to others, to whomever he chooses, not merely those of his of a physical lineage. The king is the son of God. God is the king over all the other gods. So again, this sort of this description of authority in the earthly king is superseded by the description of authority in the heavenly king. And instead of being enthroned in Jerusalem, he is enthroned above the cherubim. So, again, this we're intended to see this contrast and a shift in the book toward God being Israel's true king. But given this focus in the book on kingship and the fact that David was universally acknowledged to be the best king that Israel ever had, he's held up as the model for what a king should be. And that's actually not just true in the Bible. It's actually true even into the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, the period of kings in Europe. David was always held up as the kind of model that kings ought to aspire to. And so given that, it's not surprising that the Messiah is described as David's son. Yes, he's in David's lineage, but sonship is more than that. It's a sharing of character. It's actually in the Psalms, you will see, it's almost a sharing of identity, that he is David, and is described that way, which we'll see. So, this idea of the Messiah as David's son is developed more fully in the prophets, and we'll see that when we get into Isaiah, but we've already seen it a little bit in some of the other ones. The prophecies about the branch and things like that are all references to David. But the Psalms are where the theme of the Messiah as the descendant of David becomes not just a promise that happens to coincide with some later prophecies, but actually essential to the Messianic vision. And so in Psalms, the promise of 2 Samuel 7 that God would establish David's throne and he would always have a descendant on the throne before God becomes this kind of shadowy vision that a single descendant of David would reign like David, but unlike David, he would reign perfectly and he would reign forever. And it is a shadowy vision. I mean, if you read through Psalms, it's not clear whether the Psalms are talking about David in kind of hyperbolic and idealized terms, or whether they're looking forward into the future, or maybe a little bit of both. It's not really clear. As I've said, it's a shadowy kind of image, which the prophets will later clarify. So in Psalm 18, which we'll look at in just a second, David describes his reign. This is his assessment of his reign, which is the psalm is duplicated in 2 Samuel 22, where it's put at the end of David's reign as a kind of a summary of like what David has accomplished. In Psalm 89, the psalmist there describes David's reign in retrospect. And you'll remember we saw last time, he describes it to say, God, this is what you said was going to happen, and then none of it did. And what's up with that? And the descriptions of David's reign in the Psalms, really, or any earthly king, like Psalm 45, which is just a description of the kingship, it's always a little bit hyperbolic or idealized. It's language like, well, we'll look at Psalm 89, we looked at Psalm 89 last time, but I want you to see this language, 22 and 23. The enemy will not deceive him, nor the son of wickedness afflict him, but I shall crush his adversaries before him and strike those who hate him. Which is interesting because, I mean, David's reign wasn't as, you know, tumultuous as some of the later kings of Israel and Judah, but he definitely had some enemies. He had some problems, mostly from within his own household, but he also had people like Joab who kind of did whatever he wanted, and so that seems like a little bit idealized description of what David's reign would be like. And I think that is intended to help us see that, yeah, David was good. David was the king after God's heart, but he's not the perfect king. And in Psalms, the perfect king is God, but what we start to see in these Psalms is that there's another earthly king, a physical descendant of David, who is going to be coming and fulfilling these. And in Psalm 110, David seems to be speaking about a future king who would rule from Zion. And we'll look at the psalm in just a minute, but I want you to be looking for these when we look at Psalm 110. There's some weird details that are added to the reign of this king that I think are intended to catch our attention. And this is the foundation that Isaiah and Zechariah and the other prophets who talk about the Messiah as a king are building on. This sort of idealized or perfected reign of David. Okay, so that's all background, and I managed to get through that in, like, 14 minutes. So that's pretty good. I've done nothing else. I've accomplished that. Anything about all this sort of overview stuff that you want to ask questions about or talk about before we jump into the Psalms? All right, good. That means I've either done a good job or you're asleep. Or maybe both. Okay, so Psalm 18 is, as I've said, written by David. It's a description of his reign, but it's really a description of what God has done for him. And as I've said, it is recorded for us twice in Scripture, once here and once in 2 Samuel 22. But in both places, the historical note that's associated with it says that this was not written at the end of David's life, but rather when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. Now, that could mean that it was at the end of his reign, but it's more likely that it is the description of the sort of moment of ascension to the throne, and as David is sort of rejoicing over God's victory, and he's looking forward to the reign that God has promised to him. And so David describes his rise to the kingdom at the beginning of the psalm. It describes the sort of the battles that he had to fight and how God came to help him in his moment of crisis, or moments of crisis, we would say, looking back at David's life. And it is interesting, I asked you to think about this in the lesson sheet, to sort of look at the descriptions there in the first 19 verses of the psalm and think about what in David's life he would have described this way, you know. I think that's a useful exercise to try to not just tie a psalm to a moment in history or a moment in David's life, but actually the details, and to kind of think about, you know, why would you describe things in that way. So not in this psalm, but in other psalms, David will talk about being in a dry and weary land where there's no water, which is where he spent a lot of time while he was on the road from Saul. I mean, that image is not just a metaphor. It comes out of David's actual experience, and then he spiritualizes that to describe what it's like to be longing for God. And so things like "the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer," David spent a lot of time in among the rocks and in fortresses. And I think he's describing God in this way because that was his experience with God. It was a very real, very immediate thing for him. And that's very characteristic of David's Psalms. They're very emotional, they're very personal, one of the things that I like so much about them. So, some interesting intertextuality here. Verses 4 through 6 of Psalm 18 are reused by Jonah in his prayer in Jonah chapter 2. And I use the word "reused" there intentionally because he doesn't just quote them. He quotes bits and pieces of them, but they're scattered all through his prayer. And in some ways, I think he's using these verses to organize his prayer in Jonah 2. This is the outline, and he builds on that outline, fleshes it out with his own ideas, even tie quotes from some other psalms as well, kind of ties them together, which is a good model for us to pray from Scripture and from the Psalms. It's not just about reciting a text. It's about weaving your thoughts and experiences into the thoughts and experiences of the people in the Bible whose prayers you know have been acceptable to God. And so you use that as an outline or as a supplement, and you build your own prayer around that. Note also in verses 7 through 15, this kind of apocalyptic day of the Lord imagery. We'll come back to that in just a minute. But that's very uncharacteristic of the psalm to have imagery like that. That's much more like the later prophets. And yet, here it is, very early in Israel's history, and in fact, very early even in David's own experience. In the middle section of the Psalm 20-36, David describes why it is that God has delivered him, which is important in the context of his triumph over Saul, right? This relationship with God and David's righteousness, which he mentions several times. But part of the reason that God delivers him is David's uprightness and innocence. He says that. He's rewarded me according to my righteousness, verse 20. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has recompensed me. It's a little bit ironic, maybe, that he talks about, I have kept the ways of the Lord, I have not wickedly departed from my God. And you think about, like, the story of Nabal, where David is ready to kill him, and someone else had to come and help him obey God. But those are resources that God gave it. And if you wanted to think about it this way, because of who David was, because of his commitment to obey God, God sent someone to help him obey him even better in the person of Abigail, right? And so God is still, even in that moment, rewarding him according to his righteousness, according to the cleanness of his hands, he is rewarding him. But more importantly than David's character, God delivers him because of his own character, because of God's character. And that's what David describes in verses 24 to 30. With the kind you... That should be 25 to 30, sorry. With the kind you show yourself kind, with the blameless you show yourself blameless, with the pure you show yourself pure, and with the crooked you show yourself astute. You save an afflicted people, with haughty eyes you debase. Notice also in these verses, the parallels with Psalm 72, the description of a godly king. That's important because Psalm 72 is really just a description of what a king ought to be. It's attributed to Solomon. And I think what David is doing in this psalm is kind of saying, okay, that's going to be my model. That's what I'm going to aspire to as a king, is to have the character of the heavenly king. Caring for those who are helpless and punishing the wicked. God also delivers him with these rewards of strength and victory in battle, verses 25 to 36, and we should see that as a sign of God's deliverance, because it's God who's equipping David to have these victories. It's a continued sign of God's favor for him and his intent to make David the king by helping him attain the office and defend it. The end of the psalm then talks about David's past and present victories, verses 37 to 45. I pursued my enemies and overtook them. And notice in verse 41 that God does not save those who reject his king. The enemies cried for help, but there was none to save. They even cried to the Lord, but he didn't answer them. True thing. That's not right. God always thought, well, think about that. Why would God not save these people?
Because God doesn't save those who reject his king.
Right.
I think that's probably why.
Yes. Right. So hold on to that thought. We'll come back to it, and I think this verse will become a little bit clearer in just a second. But yeah, that really is the answer, is that if you reject the king, the one that God puts in charge, where else are you going to go for deliverance? Right? It is not symptomatic of God's lack of mercy. It is rather symptomatic of God's justice and his commitment to reward the righteous and punish the guilty. Yes?
Were you planning on commenting on 44 and 45 about the foreigners cringing before David? I'm using the ESV.
In what sense?
Just that that's also quoted in Isaiah 55.
Yes.
Okay. Right.
I was not planning on saying that, but yes, it is.
Yeah, and it's applied to Christians, that this idea that Gentiles and foreigners will come to us, and there's a sense that that's part of the sharing with the reign of Christ, I think.
That's right. Yeah, and so I wasn't going to talk about those verses specifically, but we are going to talk about this idea of the nations coming. But that's a good I mean, again, we want to see this used and reused, and that's a good observation. Those verses are quoted or are referenced in Isaiah, so that's another one that, of course, the translation of those verses is a little bit tricky, but that's another kind of idealized vision of David's kingship. I mean, yes, the kingdom was at peace, but it was not a world empire where all the nations of the world were sort of literally cringing and coming to him begging for mercy, right? And so again, we start to see in that this kind of, you know, an expectation that there might be something better in the future, a better fulfillment of this. And so then finally David concludes in verses 46 to 50 with the praise of God for his deliverance to him. Verse 50, he gives great deliverance to his king, shows loving kindness to his anointed, to David and his descendants forever. Okay, I said we were going to talk about the nations thing. In the lesson, I asked you to think about verse 49. Therefore, I will give thanks to you among the nations, O Lord. I will sing praises to your name. That word nations is the word goyim, which is translated in in the New Testament, well, it's Greek in the New Testament, but it's translated as Gentiles in the New Testament. So, what I want us to think about is this. How might Paul's use of Psalm 18:49 in Romans 15 recolor our reading of Psalm 18? So, we know that Paul quotes this verse to say this is going to be true of Jesus' reign. I can read that verse for those of you that didn't do your lesson. Romans 15, verse 8, I say that Christ has become a servant to the circumcision on behalf of the truth of God to confirm the promises given to the fathers and for the Gentiles to glorify God for his mercy. As it is written, therefore I will give praise to you among the Gentiles and I will sing to your name. And then he quotes from some other Old Testament passages as well. Including Deuteronomy and Psalm 117, but I want us to focus on the reference to Psalm 18 here in verse 9. So given that, do you think we should look for other parallels between Christ's life and death in Psalm 18? And what do you see? What do you see in this psalm that kind of reminds you of something that Christ experienced?
Yeah. Well, there's times where, like the Syrophoenician woman or the people in Decapolis would come to Jesus looking for healings and stuff like that. So you've got that same imagery, people coming and flocking to
Him. Yep. Good. What else? What about with the kind you show yourself kind, with the blameless you show yourself blameless, with the pure you show yourself pure? How did Jesus respond to people who humbly sought him and who kind of came to him on his terms with humility and looking, hungering and thirsting after righteousness? How did he behave towards them as opposed to those who resisted him?
He would fill them.
Right. So with the pure, he showed himself pure. With the blameless, he showed himself blameless. But with the crooked, he showed himself astute. Actually, it's kind of funny. Literally, that with the crooked, you show yourself twisted, which is really just that. It's that responding in kind image. If you're going to mess this up, I'm going to mess you up, is the basic idea.
A little bit
colloquial.
A lot of the responses to the Pharisees.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That is very much a part of Christ's character. What about verses 4 through 6? Use your imagination. What could that possibly describe?
Well, maybe some of the... I know initially when they think about getting close to... during the crucifixion, but maybe the trials.
Yeah.
You've got all these people kind of around him and saying these things, and, you know, he's being passed back and forth, so that's almost like a noose tightening.
Yeah,
as he's going back and forth.
Yeah. So, in fact, I actually think you can look at basically every section of this psalm and see a description of Christ's rise and reign. Christ became the king through suffering and death, just as David did, in a more intense way, of course. I put some references here on the side of New Testament passages that kind of capture the same idea, and you can... You can look at these in more detail later. I'll just reference them briefly, but that Christ had to suffer in order to reign. Verses 4 through 6 are quoted by Jonah, and you remember what did Jesus say was the sign that he would give them? The sign of Jonah. That is, Jonah was... And so that's one thing to go, okay, fine, Jonah, 3 days and three nights. But he always connects it to his suffering and his rise from the dead, right? So... I think I think we're intended to see this connection. Jonah quotes this psalm, and these verses are also a really apt description of what Christ suffered on the cross. Now, we don't know what he was thinking on the cross beyond what he said, but, I mean, if anything described what Christ went through, the cords of Sheol surrounded me, the snares of death confronted me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord. I cried to my God for help. My God, why have you forsaken me? I mean, it's so precise that I can't help reading this and thinking about Christ. And I think the connection through Jonah is intended to help us see that.
And Mason, even in verse 7,
yeah,
the earth reeled and rocked. There
right.
was an earthquake when he was on the cross.
And there's all these references to darkness in verses 7 through 15. The foundations of the world were laid bare at your rebuke, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils. Again, maybe not a literal description of what was going to happen, and certainly not a prophecy of what was going to happen, but it is definitely representative of what Christ went through. And this apocalyptic day of the Lord imagery, which is going to get discussed and described in more detail in the other prophets, some of which we've already looked at, is picked up in Acts 2 by the apostles to say, that's now, that's today. And so again, it's not a quotation, but it is definitely a use and reuse situation. In verses 20 to 36, you can kind of imagine Christ describing me, why God delivered him. He, of course, was totally innocent, totally upright. And 2 Corinthians 5 talks about that. But it was also, Paul makes this point very strongly in Romans, that the salvation through the death of Christ was to demonstrate God's own righteousness so that he could be both the just and the justifier in punishing sin, but also in forgiving it. And so as a result of what Christ accomplished, he was given the rewards, the strength, the victory in battle. In Ephesians chapter 1 talks about that when he had done all these things, he ascended and he sat down at the right hand of God. Just like David, but more so, Christ has conquered all of his enemies. Romans 6, 9, Colossians 2, 15 talk about that. And then when we get to verse 41, now it makes even more sense. Because what does Hebrews 10 say about those who reject the Son of God? There's no longer any hope for them, right? And that's not God being unmerciful. It's God being just. It's God saying, this is the king. If you don't submit to him, you're not a part of the kingdom, and I can't help you. In fact, remember what Jesus said would happen at the final judgment. Did we not cast out demons in your name? Did we not prophesy in your name? And he says, depart from me, I never knew you. Right? They are rejecting his kingship. They're rejecting his authority, and therefore God judges them. And then this concluding praise of God for his deliverance. So Paul quotes verse 49 to show that Christ's victory in the cross fulfilled all the promises of the Old Testament, both for Gentiles and Jews. And then, but earlier in the chapter, in verse 6, Romans 15, verse 6, Paul explicitly calls all the nations to glorify God with one voice. So, again, this sort of, this intertextuality, this reuse of these ideas. If David's description of his own reign is a little bit hyperbolic, a little bit idealized, it isn't idealized when you apply it to the reign of Christ. And if David's description of his sufferings maybe sounds a little bit melodramatic, like, okay, David, you weren't literally tied up by death, it's not hyperbolic when you apply it to Christ, right? Christ never fought a physical battle in his time on earth, but that language is all over Messianic prophecy and the New Testament to describe his spiritual victories. And so I think we need to read the Messianic Psalms not just as proof texts that Jesus is the Messiah. That's not the way they're being used in the New Testament, which we'll see in just a minute. We need to read them as descriptive of his life and death and reign, because Christ is the fulfillment and the ultimate expression of every type and image in the Old Testament. And so when we see David describing his reign in Psalm 18, what we need to also see is a description of what Christ's reign would be. Only more. Only better. And so the verses that are quoted in the New Testament really should serve as hooks back into the Psalms and not simply as a proof text that Jesus is the Messiah. Anything about else about Psalm 18 that you want to point out? Questions or anything?
You can just see where the Jews would have got the idea that when Jesus came, and if they would have been able to properly identify him, why they would have had the impression that this guy is going to destroy the Roman Empire literally, because that's what the imagery is.
Yep. And we'll talk in just a minute about the triumphal entry, but one of the things they say in the triumphal entry is Hosanna to the Son of David, with images like this in mind, of destroying the whole world, you know, all the enemies and all nations submitting to him, foreigners coming and cringing before him as soon as they hear him, and that kind of thing. They very much have this idea in their minds, which is, I think, going back to our discussion from Daniel, why Jesus intentionally chooses the sort of the most obscure reference to the Messiah in the Old Testament to describe himself. But you can definitely see where that those ideas come from. Anything else? Okay, so that's the idea of the king that is coming as the son of David, meaning one who is like David. But as it turns out, he's not just like David, he's more than David, sort of David squared or something. David perfected and David's reign perfected. We've already talked a little bit about how Psalms are quoted as messianic in the New Testament, but we're moving away now from the kingship Psalms. We're about to do Psalm 10, but we're moving away from the kingship Psalms into a slightly different area of messianic Psalms, which are those that are perhaps not explicitly king-related, but are nonetheless quoted in the New Testament. And so that gives us a slightly different task in reading them, because we can't just make the one-to-one correlation between the king and Christ. And the reason I've included Psalm 110 is because Psalm 110 is a king psalm, but it's got a bunch of weird stuff in it that I think we need to address that the New Testament really helps us to clarify. So they're quoted in the New Testament, these psalms that are like this, largely along typological lines, meaning that Jesus' actions are the most perfect expression of the idea that are found in the psalms. A very good example of this is John 2:17. Jesus cleanses the temple, and the disciples remember that it was written, what? Zeal for your house has eaten me up. Psalm 69. Go read Psalm 69. Not about cleansing the temple. Not even close. Right? In the context, it's someone who's being persecuted because he wants to do what's right. Which is also not descriptive of what was happening when Jesus cleansed the temple, especially the first time in the Gospel of John. So, what's going on there? Well, don't you think it ought to be characteristic of God's people that zeal for God's house eats them up? That it is all-consuming? I think it is. That zeal for the things that God has asked them to do for God's worship and God's service consumes their entire mind? I think so. And Jesus is the perfect example of that. And that's what the disciples remembered. They said, oh yeah, that's what people who love God are like. Zeal for God's house has eaten them up. Right? That's what's going on in Psalm 2, and that's really characteristic of the way the Psalms are quoted in the New Testament. In other words, they're not directly prophetic, mostly. There are some weird ones, and we're going to look at some of them. But like Psalm 69:21, I think I said... Psalm 69:21 is they gave me gall for my food and vinegar for my drink. That might be messianic in the sense that David is clearly not saying that they literally gave me these to drink. So why does he say that? Why does he describe it that way? Not why does he describe the bitterness of people's treatment of him, but why does he use those specific images? And then why does that literally happen to Jesus in the New Testament? Right? It's more than just a correlation that's described in kind of similar terms. It's like an exact thing that happens in the, it is an exact thing that happens in the New Testament. So that's a little bit, that's a little bit tricky. Psalm 110:1, Jesus kind of, we'll talk about that. 118:22, several others that you can find, they kind of fall in this gray area between typology and prophecy. So I'm not going to be totally dogmatic about it, but I think it is true that generally this is how the psalm was quoted in the New Testament. But I want you to see that this does not reduce the power or inspiration of these verses as messianic. Jesus identified the book of Psalms, the whole book of Psalms, as being about him in Luke 24:44-45, as well as the rest of the Old Testament. But he specifically mentions the Psalms there, and I think that's worth something. He even, in his ministry, identified specific parts of Psalms as really being only about him, and that's the Psalm 110:1 reference. Jesus says, well, who's David talking about? Well, I don't know. It's me. And it couldn't really be anybody else. So they are certainly messianic, and they are certainly powerful in that regard. And the writer of Hebrews, of course, implies that only Christ could fulfill Psalm 110:4 in its fullest sense, the high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Part of the point that the writer of Hebrews is making is there's no other way for that to work except for someone who's not from the tribe of Levi, someone who could supersede the Levitical priesthood in both time and imminence to fulfill that. And I do not know what I meant by that last point. That's not poorly worded. And that's not well worded. All right, we'll skip it. Good. So this is how the Psalms are quoted in the Old Testament. How they're quoted in the New Testament. And let's look at some examples of that. Let's look at Psalm 110. This psalm is very familiar to us, and in fact, I'm going to probably make some people angry by mostly skipping over the parts that you're already familiar with. Verse 1 and verse 4 specifically. We'll address them briefly in context.